Welcome, welcome, welcome to It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. I'm your host, Tom, and alongside me is a man who sounds like a penguin wiping his bottom on a roll of silk. The epitome of shush, the prince of peace and quiet, the muffled magnificence that is Silent Dave. Episode 12 is entitled Disappointment is an Old Friend, and I think we can all share a tissue and take a moment. On the menu tonight, the excellent showing against Leeds, the finely poised draw against Benfica in the Europa League, and the acid test against the runaway Premier League leaders, money bag Chester City. We'll be nipping over the pond for American Arsenology with Isaiah, bolting ourselves in the gum room with Jay. And what about this, peeps? Very excited here. Our guest is a speaker, former athlete and throwing coach for Ajax and Liverpool, Thomas Gronemark. Thomas held the Guinness World Record for the longest throw-in. That's 51.33 metres. What's that in real terms? That's the length of two swimming pools or four transit buses and a Mini Cooper. Or alternatively, 46 and a half shopping trolleys, either full or empty from Sainsbury's, Tesco or Asda. Make sure you get your pound back. Dave, that's staggering. I can't believe it. It's such a distance. I mean, when I used to go out on a Saturday night on the Razzle and play for the pub side on a Sunday, you were lucky if I could throw 2 feet and probably to the right player. What's this you're giving me? Right, it's just offered me a little bit of paper. Let me just unravel that a minute. It's your own comparison. Okay, we'll go with that. 51.33, that's apparently the length of 29 Boris Johnson's laying end-to-end, plus the radius of a bike wheel. You made that up. Does it include the Buffon? He's shrugging. The current world record holder for the throwing is Michael Lewis from the United States of America, 59.817 metres, which is 196 feet and 3 inches. Get out of here! Now, we were talking, Dave and myself, about the first thing we will do after lockdown is over. It will be like stepping into a new world, a land of opportunity. The theatre, cinema, pubs, clubs, restaurants, snooker halls, football matches, and Dave, hairdressers. I said to Dave, what are you looking forward to the most after lockdown's over? And Dave said, he was looking forward to going to B&Q. To buy a new drill. And I said, well, you can buy that online. And he said, I like to feel it in my hand. I'm making absolutely no comment. My solicitor is in the Seychelles counting her houses.
It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. Fun, football and conversation.
Right, on to the Leeds match. Arsenal managed to entertain and dominate Leeds in a Premier League clash that could have gone either way. I'd actually forecast that it could have ended 5-5 or 6-0 in either direction because both are guilty of massive inconsistencies this campaign. Although some Arsenal fans may cite bad luck as a factor. Leeds, however, have either won or lost by heavy margins, playing an open, adventurous and attacking game, which probably makes them one of the most watchable sides in the Premier League. Berated for their style of play at the expense of points, Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds play to entertain with a game full of purpose and energy. The difference in this clash between two very old, established former giants of the game was the approach that Arsenal employed. All too often, they have invited pressure from Leeds, allowed themselves to become overrun and outmaneuvered by the Premier League's new arrivals. But this wasn't the case here. Arteta, sick of his usual two forms of luck, good and none, primed his troops to seize the opportunity, and Arsenal came out fast from the first whistle, full of intent and cutting edge. They were full of passes that were precise, long or short, and showed real desire to get forward and hurt the opponents and punish any mistakes. No one personified this ethic more than Bukayo Saka, who bossed this game and was a constant threat to Leeds every time he got the ball at his feet. This was the youngster's best and most complete performance, and one wonders what he can produce eventually at the peak of his powers. It's a matter of urgency for Arsenal to sign this lad to a long-term contract. At this rate, Saka will be the star of this side and probably one of the brightest ever to grace the international stage. He's a natural attacker that knows his own game, and he has no influences other than driving forward and getting into key areas to either provide a killer pass or add a devastating finish to a move, which he's generally heavily involved in. It was his efficiency and potency and ambition that took this game away from Leeds, and the visitors just didn't know what to do with him. He has fabulous close control and balance and can cut through a swathe of players where no space exists. It was no surprise when Saka hit the thrusters to draw a desperately clumsy lunge barge combo from Cooper around 35 minutes. It might have been a tad soft, but it was a penalty. Yet again, we got stuffed by VAR and the referee, who conspired to snatch away a deserved lead. No one was more annoyed than Arteta, who fumed and hacked through the air with an arm like it was like it had a sword cutting through an opponent. Saka complained to himself quietly, but instead of drowning in self-pity, he just took the game up a notch. With 49 minutes on the clock, Saka pounced on a mistake by Messala, who thought he had all day to dwell on the ball. Saka was intent on robbing the Leeds goalkeeper, and poor judgment and timing did the rest, with Saka being floored in desperation. Up stepped Aubameyang to score his second goal of the game. The first was his trademark cut-in from the left after 13 minutes, where he completely bamboozled Haaland and forced the ball past a stranded Messala. The smile was back. Whatever had been on the striker's mind this season, he suddenly looked as if he'd found a cure or a solution. This penalty was emphatic, just like this Arsenal performance, as Leeds struggled to get any sort of foothold in the game. Just as Leeds managed to show some form of pressure, they found themselves 3-0 down after 45 minutes, courtesy of Hector Bellerin, who hadn't been on the score sheet at the Emirates for 2 years. Saka provided the threat, Bellerin ploughed into the box, and Ceballos provided the cute little dink into his path. So at half time, everything looked polished and perfect in the Arsenal universe, but Leeds weren't going to accept a drubbing. Oh no, it's not in them. I never expected them to drop their intensity, and they were soon back in the game, but not before they had to suffer a fourth goal from who else but Aubameyang, provided by the combination of Saka and the excellent Smith Rowe, who's at ease at this level. Aubameyang got on the end of an exquisite cross that just saw players completely pulled out of their positions. Rafinha was the pick of the Leeds players, but it was Pascal Strauch who opened the visitors' account by jumping higher than anyone else and powering the ball into the net with his head. The visitors' second came from Costa, 68 minutes had gone, who was released by Roberts for a deserved goal. 4-2, and that's how it stayed, but it could have easily been 8-4. But better still, it was a stunning advert for the Premiership. This was everything that makes it the most enjoyable league in the world. Both sides playing a game that was open-ended, full of entertainment, and brimming with talking points. It's the best Arsenal performance and game this season so far by some distance, and although Aubameyang grabbed the headlines, Saka was my man of the match.
It's an Arsenal Thing podcast with your hosts, Tom, Silent Dave, Isaiah, and Jay. Fun, football, and conversation.
I don't know about you, but lockdown has had a severe effect on my brain. Yes, it has. I now know how many plug sockets I've got in the house, which is slightly odd. It's not as odd as going to the fridge 9 times in an hour just to see what's in there. We haven't had a food delivery. No one's broken in and left me a surprise gift in the fridge. But I keep going there. I keep checking it out. It's really odd. Odder still. I've been to the shed and I've got out all my screws. And I've sorted them out into sizes. I put them in boxes and I've marked them up. I don't do that. What I do is I just chuck them in a big box or a tin. So very, very strange goings on there. But I had a chat with the lads and we decided the best way to use this endless sea of time is to come up with our own foreign footballer name. Now, what you have to do is you have to amalgamate the names of two of your best friends and put them with your last holiday destination. So mine was a combination of Dave and Abby. So I became Davab Marbella. Davab Marbella. It's got some potential, that. Dave's was slightly less successful. It was Rickom Margate, a combination of Rick and Tom. He doesn't get out much, bless him. He's on a day release. You've got some work to do there, Dave. Drop the E off the end and you can become Rickom Margat. Hey, do you see that? Hey, that sounds much better. You could be a left back for Spoondingdon Wanderers. That needs some work as well. It won't always work, I'm sure, but another friend of ours has come up with Sijak Maldives. Hey, that's good. That is good. A combination of Simon and Jack and obviously the Maldives. Less successful is Kevinny Lanzarotti. Kevin Tony and Lanzarotti as the destination. Although, having said that, I could see him as a potential summer Arsenal target for about 25 million. Have a go. See what you come up with. It's better than counting your spaghetti or lining up your grapes or stuff like that. Try and use your brain in a very useful but stupid fashion.
It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. Fun, football and conversation.
Our guest tonight has had an astonishing and varied sporting career. He's a speaker, he's an author, and a throwing coach for Ajax and Liverpool. Please give it up for Thomas Gronemark. Well, Thomas, lovely to meet you. Heard so much about you. You've kind of been in the press quite a bit recently as well. Let's take it back, really. You've had such a varied sporting career that's led you to where you are now. Can you tell us how you started out?
Yeah, you can say, just to make a short recap of my sporting background. I played football until U19, and I played in the best Danish U19 league. Also played against good players like, for example, Thomas Gravesen, who later played for Celtic and Real Madrid. But I wasn't good enough to be a professional football player. I was really fast and I could make really good throw-ins. So in the mid-90s, I changed to athletics. And the first year I came on the Danish national team in athletics in Denmark, running 100, 200, 400 meters in relays. And I wasn't that sport for 6 years on the Danish national team, more years. And yeah, best wrestlers was Danish champion several times, and then European champion on the 4x400 meter relay for club teams in 2000 in Paris. In 2002, I've never been better, but I've just moved to the western part of Denmark to a small town because I've met my wife, and sometimes you do crazy things because of love. So suddenly I was training alone and I had to find I thought a team sport. So in 2002, I came to the Danish national bobsleigh team, and I was on that team for 4 years. We were traveling all around the world, Europe, Canada, the States, and it was fantastic 4 years. And it was in the middle of that bobsleigh period where I thought, hey, if I can make a good throw-in, can't I teach other players to do it? So I went down to my local library after a bobsleigh trip and tried to find a book about throw-ins. But there were no books at all, so I had to do my own course. And so after 6 months, I had made my own course. And yeah, I could have been starting with a youth or amateur team, but I had the courage to ask a local Superliga team from Denmark called Viborg. And they said yes, and they scored a lot of goals on throw-ins, improved a lot. And the year after, it was FC Midtjylland, an even better Superliga team from Denmark. And yeah, and then it went on with then one pro team, the next pro team. And then the big breakthrough came in July 2018, where Jurgen Klopp, you all know from Liverpool FC, called me directly and asked me for help to improve their throw-ins.
That's some phone call to get, isn't it?
Yeah, that was totally crazy because, you know, I've always dreamed about coaching the biggest club in the world. And I've also always been sure that I would achieve it at some point. But in 2018, I didn't know if it would go a year or perhaps 30 years before I got that chance. So Jurgen Klopp calling me directly on the phone, that was like both a shock, but also like a dream come true.
I bet your phone was ringing off the hook after that. When people found out Jurgen Klopp was on the phone to you, I bet your phone lit up like a Christmas tree.
Yeah, it was totally crazy. You know, the first couple of months, no one heard about it because I was asked to keep it secret, and that was fine for me. But it was leaked in the end of August. I think someone in Liverpool FC, there's many people there, have leaked it to some journalist. And then, it just happened. I think the last 2.5 years have been giving approximately 300 interviews to journalists all over the world, and especially in the start, like the last first couple of months after the news came out, it was totally crazy. So
for a while back in 2010, you got the world record of 51.33 meters. That's only just recently been broken, hasn't it?
Yeah, I set the world record in 2010, and it was because in 2004 I started as a throwing coach. In 2008, I thought, hey, I'm the only throwing coach in the world. Why not be the world's best? So, my goal was to beat the official Guinness World Record there. I could throw very far with a normal running, but I knew I had to do something special to beat it. So I beat the world record with the flip throwing, and that was a little bit special also because I'm a non-gymnast, so it took really long time to learn. But you know, I have had fantastic experiences both with record attempt in the national match between Denmark and Spain, full stadium there in 2008. Had a world record attempt in 2009 in a match between Hertha Berlin and Wolfsburg, 40,000 spectators on the Olympic Stadium in Berlin, and then I beat the world record in 2010. It was at a girls' football school in Denmark, so a little bit more, not the same as the Olympic Stadium in Berlin. But, you know, it was really fantastic to beat the world record and be the world's best. And then a little short story about the guy who beat my world record, because I had the world record for almost 10 years. It was beaten by an American called Michael Lewis, and he threw, 59.81, so that was crazy. But actually, instead of being angry on him taking my world record, I just saluted Michael, and actually I invited him to Denmark to here last summer because I made a trial for him in a Danish third league club, so to give him the chance to try himself out. Michael Lewis is coming from the States, from Texas, so. And he also did a world record attempt there in Denmark. Here in Denmark, he was only like 31 centimeters from his own world record there. But you can see that on my YouTube channel. One thing is that it's spectacular when I did my world record, but when you see Michael do it, it's like, yeah, the best throw you'll ever see. So
I did look it up. I was watching. You were very encouraging. Can you tell us the sort of basics of the training? Because we'll do all the sort of links and stuff later on so people can look it up. But what's the basics of your training?
Yeah, a lot of people think I'm only coaching the long throwing. And I'll say I'm coaching that also in all my clubs. You know, most players are improving between 5 and 15 meters with my coaching. It's only technical training and video analysis. It's not going into the weight room. So, for example, I had a guy from FC Midtjylland, a young guy, Andreas Paulsen. He improved his throwing from 24.25 meters to 37.90, so almost 14 meters. He was sold to Borussia and Gladbach. But long throw-ins, they're really important, no matter if you want to use it as a set-piece weapon. For example, in Liverpool, we don't use it. In Ajax, we didn't use it. But it's really important, especially for fullbacks and wingers, because the longer throw-in you have, the greater throw-in area you can have too, and then you can throw some more teammates. So no matter what clubs I'm coaching in, I'm using sometimes on developing the long throw-ins. But it's actually only like 5 or 10% of my training. I'm coaching after my philosophy called the long, the fast, and the clever throw-in. And 90% of the time it's on the fast and clever throw-in. And just to make a short recap of it, fast throw-ins, that's all about reacting fast, throwing the ball fast, but also know when not to throw the ball fast, because some people think, oh, you have to throw it fast. No, one of the worst things you can do is throw it fast into a pressure zone. So I'm learning the players when to throw fast, when to have patience. But it's also when the opponents have a throw-in, how to mark fast, how to coordinate, how to communicate, how to organize. So it's everything around fast throw-ins, taking decisions and reacting. And then the clever throw-in, I'm working with three different zones. I'm having approximately 50 different throw-in tools. And then some people think, oh, it's a little bit like American football. You just have a playbook. No, not at all. It's just like basic tools because the players, they are they're using their own fantasy and creativity, imagination. So in theory, my teams have millions of tools and solutions. It's a little bit like, just imagine back in the days with the tiki-taka in Barcelona. It was not like Barcelona said, okay, Messi, run there, Xavi, run there, Iniesta, run there. No, they did a lot of rondos. They were playing with their tiki-taka intelligence, so they can do it like in millions of ways. And it's the same I do with my my throwing coaching, working on the players' throwing intelligence. And it's not, of course, only the thrower. It's all the players on the pitch, how they create space. So when one of my jobs have scored after throwing situation all around the pitch, some people and analysis people are saying, oh, if you want to have the same success, you just have to make this guy run there, the one guy there, run guy there. No, they're totally mistaken. I'm not setting the players up to do specific patterns. Of course, it's easy to do that. That's the easiest thing in the world. It's much harder to learn the basic throwing intelligence to take their own decisions. Because, you know, when if the opponents are marking you, the thing you try to do, develop space in some area, then you have to be able to see spaces developed in perhaps 3, 4, 5, 6 other places on the pitch and know how to do it. So that's how I'm working with my throwing coaching.
I think the thing I didn't realize as well, because I think I read it on one of your blogs, it's you get 40 to 60 throw-ins per match and the ball is lost 50% of the time. I mean, it's quite staggering, isn't it? And it also goes back to a day when when I was doing football many years ago, throw-ins were just done really quickly to try and catch opponents out, to get up as far up the pitch as you could. I mean, that was the kind of purpose of it. But there's so much detail. Looking at the videos, you kind of think, well, why did no one pick up on this before? It's a real science. You must have met with some resistance when you first came out.
Yeah, a lot. The first many years, I was primarily coaching in Denmark. And the first years, it was only long throw-ins. And then I started working on the fast and clever ones too. And of course, there was a lot of resistance there. But I think the greatest resistance was when my job in Liverpool was revealed or leaked in August 2018. There was a lot of resistance there, a lot of really ugly and really negative criticism. I don't mind criticism. It's one of the most important things we have. But I was by many people really ridiculed. But that's really like change from, every day that's gone since then, it has changed. I'm not meeting any coach or manager, head coach, analysis people who's not saying, hey, it's brilliant, it's good, why haven't we done that before? And even if you look at rival fans, of course, there are still some rival fans who think I'm an idiot or crazy or something like that. But actually, you can see a lot of rival fans from the clubs I'm coaching, they're now saying, hey, why we should also do throwing coaching or get this throwing coach to our club. And that's fine for me because even though I've been in Liverpool for 3 seasons now, I'm a freelance throwing coach. I'm coaching, the last seasons, 3 seasons, been coaching 6, 8 different professional clubs all around the world per season. And it could also be other clubs in the Premier League. So I'm going all in on my clubs I'm coaching in the specific seasons. But all in all, my biggest dream and my biggest goal is to change football. So you can say I'm a servant of football, not a servant of specific clubs.
I tell you, when it changed for me, the humble throw-in, if you like, was the first time I saw Rory Delap. And I thought, wow, this guy is special. As an Arsenal supporter, and obviously it's an Arsenal podcast, he used to put the fear of God into our defence every time he got a throw in. I think you comment on his skill as well.
Yeah, you know, he was fantastic. Before I go into Rory Delap and Stoke, it's really important for me to say that it's perhaps only 5 or 10% of all teams who can like utilize this playing style with a lot of long throw-ins. So don't misunderstand me. I don't want to have every team playing like this. But you know, first of all, Rodilab, he had a world-class throw-in, length, flatness. The throw-in was hard. But also, I read that, Stoke had 8 out of 11 on the start 11 was 1.90 meters or above. And imagine playing Arsenal. I've seen their games against Arsenal. Arsenal has always been, even though they Arsenal have had a couple of big guys, of course, in the defense, it was more like smaller technical players. And imagine, like, 8 guys from Stoke standing there, crowding the penalty area, and then Rodilab was standing there. It must have been a nightmare. And I know Stoke scored a lot of goals against Arsenal. So yes, Rodilab was phenomenal, and I really love that teams are going all in on a specific playing style. But I wouldn't like that all were playing like this. I've had teams also, you know, in my career where we score a lot of goals. For example, FC Midtjylland, not the last 2 seasons here, but the 4 seasons before, Midtjylland scored 35 goals and long throw-ins in these 4 seasons, so approximately 9 per season. I had one season in the 16-17 season in the Danish Superliga, AC Horsens, they scored 10 goals after long throw-ins. So yes, it's possible to do that. If the club has the playing style, you have the, you know, tall and strong players. But, you know, it's not a playing style for Liverpool. It's not a playing style for Ajax. It will also not be a playing style for Arsenal. So you have to look at the playing style too. But it would be really like stupid to count out throw-ins because you're not seeing long throw-ins, because that's, again, in my perspective, only like 10% of the throw-ins, or even perhaps only 5%. So I think every team could improve their general performance a lot if they focus more on throw-ins.
So let's take you back to 2018. Jurgen Klopp phoned you. Did you actually believe it was Jurgen Klopp?
Yeah, a lot of people have actually, asked me that. And actually, I also had a lot of time to like think about that, because he didn't catch me the first time, because he put a message on my mobile phone, on my voicemail, because I had turned my phone like off because I was on a family trip. So I just saw a plus 44 number been ringing to me. And I thought it was a guy from England selling me some pens or so, because if you have a company like me, a lot of people phone you. So when I heard the voicemail, it was Jurgen Klopp, I was totally surprised. Again, a lot of people said, oh, didn't you think it was someone making fun? But you know, when you have heard Jurgen Klopp's voice, it's Jurgen Klopp. So, but of course, I was surprised. So, but he didn't answer when I called him back, and I just thought, hey, I might as well go home to myself to take the most important call in my life. So, but when I was driving in the car with my wife and my kids in the back, you know, he suddenly called, and my wife said it was Jurgen. So I just drove to the side into a grass field, so yes, it's changed my life that Jurgen chose to call me. And of course, it was because Liverpool, even though they had a good season in the 17-18 season with a 4th place in the Premier League and Champions League final, even though they lost to Madrid, they were horrible at the throw-in. So Liverpool were actually only number 18 out of 20 in the Premier League on throw-ins under pressure where the players are marked, with a possession on 45.4%. But in my first season, 18-19 season, we improved to 68.4% and went to number 1 in the Premier League, also number 2 in Europe, just after FC Midtjylland from Denmark, one of my other teams. So you can improve your throw-ins no matter what team you are.
I bet it was fairly tough to contain yourself when you got that phone call as well. What was your first meeting like with Jurgen Klopp?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was he invited me to Millwood, yeah, Liverpool's former training ground, the week after the phone call. And you know, before I was really nervous, and you know, I should have a confirmation mail from the club of the meeting and the plane tickets, and it didn't really come the first, and I thought, hey, something's wrong. And you know, sometimes when there's really, really, really big things happening in your life. So, but you know, when I came to Melwood, I really felt welcome. I wasn't nervous at all. You know, first of all, it should only be a meeting with Jurgen Klopp, but I had, because Jurgen Klopp was so convinced, I had a chance to coach 21 Premier League players already the day after the meeting. And I think it was a week after the visit to Millwood, I signed my first half-year contract. I guess that Liverpool should like really see what effect does my throwing coaching have. But already like October that year or so, November that year, I signed another 6 months contract. And then the last two seasons, I've been signing full season contracts. So so yes, it's been a dream come true for me to work, you know, with a top club in the Premier League. So
it's not a bad name to have on your CV either, is it? Jurgen Klopp.
No, it's really good. It's fantastic. But what I really like here is that I've been given an open role in Liverpool FC. It's not like when I came there, Liverpool or Jurgen Klopp said, hey, you have to do like this or this or this, or do like we did last year and just polish it a little. No, they've been trusting me and my knowledge. I've been working as a throwing coach for now. It's the 17th year. I've been working with it every day, every hour. They've been trusting me that I could help the club to improve. So,
well, I'm just going to read this out because you've heard it 1,000 times, I dare say. But Jurgen Klopp said, let's be 100% clear. I wanted to employ him. You cannot have enough specialists around you. Already, he's made a difference. I mean, that's gold, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's really, sometimes I don't know what you say in English, like pinching my arm. Do you say that in English?
Pinching yourself.
Yeah. You know, sometimes it's a little bit unrealistic what's happening. And even though I'm in the middle of it and been that for 3 seasons, sometimes when I read like a thing Jürgen have been saying or another coach or another club about my coaching, it's a little bit like, is it real or what? But you know, been working many years for this, so but again, I'm still happy it came through. So
it's a bit like we're pinching ourselves having you on this podcast. So you're with Liverpool. How did you start off? Did you watch a lot of match day videos, or did you go into the training to assess? How did you start?
I just started with, of course, I've been seeing some videos, but you know, no matter what team I'm looking at at least in Europe, I'm pretty sure what to improve. But in general, I think that the level of throw-ins are really bad. So normally the players have to learn everything from scratch. And because most of the players haven't really coached throw-ins, so what I'm normally starting with is like improve the player's length, improve the player's precision on short distance. And I'm also learning them to the feeling of basic space creation when they have a throw-in, because the players are not really used to moving and helping each other to create space when there's a throw-in situation. So you have to learn all the basic things, because when I'm asking the player, have you ever done any throw-in coaching? Most of the players are saying no, and a few are saying a little bit. Then I'm asking the manager or the head coach that they haven't really done anything. They expect that the academies are doing it, perhaps. And then I'm asking the academy coaches. They didn't do anything at all. Or they should have learned that when they were kids. Then I'm asking the kids coaches. They didn't do anything. And it's not because it's bad coaches. It's just the coaches have been lacking knowledge. What do you have to do? So most coaches, no matter if we're talking about kids, youth players, amateur players, Sunday league or pros, even Champions League, Premier League, they've just been used to just throwing the ball down the line, hurl it up there, because the further you get it away, the further away you can lose the ball. And perhaps we're lucky to keep it. But that's just like from my point of view, a bad approach, because there are much bigger risks that you'll lose the ball than keep, and especially also create chances and score goals after throwing situations. So, but back to the basic, it's that the coaches, managers, head coaches, assistant coaches have been lacking knowledge. So that's what I'm giving both the coaches and the players.
You're kind of getting the players as well to assess the individual situations, to kind of map out where they're going to put the ball next. And the video is very helpful and very detailed in that respect. Obviously, the coaching creates two trains of thought. The Daily Mirror published an article saying that Jose Mourinho was concentrating on defending the throw-ins from Liverpool. Such was the sort of danger from the throw-ins from your training. And then you've got the flip side of it, where you've got Andy Gray, a football pundit, who mocked the idea of the throwing, and Steve Nicol, who scoffed at the sort of theory of the throwing. I mean, I've seen both of those take throws. So I don't know what they're on about. But it really does have that sort of mixture at the moment, although I think attitudes are changing. But it's got that negative-positive thing.
Yeah, first of all, I can understand why Jose Mourinho, he used time for the throw-ins, because when you're hearing a team who's best at possession, it's really hard to take the ball from them, and they also take the ball from you. When you have a throw-in, of course, you get worried. When you hear a team who's been scoring 14 goals like Liverpool did, we did last season, after the throw-in situation, of course, You are worried, especially because we scored against Spurs, who also the winner last season after the throw-in. So I can understand Jose Mourinho, what he did. Of course, it's always a balance. Do you want to use 30 minutes or are you using 4 hours? I don't know how much time he used. So, but I can understand why you want to prepare against my teams with the throw-ins. And then just what you said about Andy Gray and Steve Nicol. For me, you know, there are very few people who are like having this approach to my throwing coaching. Of course, they got a lot of attention because they're in media and on live on TV channels, ESPN and BN Sports and so. But, you know, if you saw the reaction of these two pundits, I didn't. Of course, I answered in some interviews, but actually the...
Well, you must be used to it, mustn't you, really, the scepticism. But how do you feel about that? How do you deal with that?
Oh, that's easy. I'm using a thing I'm calling the good, the bad, and the ugly criticism. I try to slice the criticism off. First of all, it's important for me to say criticism is one of the best things in life. If we haven't got criticism, we will never be better. So if we have constructive criticism, and I take that a lot from the players, from the other coaches, if I'm meeting a security guy on the pitch who's saying, hey, couldn't you use the yellow cones too to this and this? So I'm always trying to be better and listen. And that's what I call constructive criticism. So that's good. Bad criticism can also be good sometimes. That might sound a little bit crazy, but sometimes, for example, on social media, there's a guy writing to me saying, hey, why are you a throwing coach? It's only a little thing. It doesn't give any meaning. So I could choose to say, hey, you don't know anything at all. I don't want to talk with you. But often I choose to say, hey, did you know that there's actually 40 to 60 throw-ins in a match? Most teams have possession under 50% of the occasions when they have a throw-in under pressure, where the players are marked. And often these guys who are getting this knowledge they didn't have before, they're saying, hey, I didn't know that. And suddenly we have a dialogue. And not every time, but often I get also some inspiration, but also information and help from these people. So we shouldn't count out criticism just because it looks negative. And then there's the last part, what I call ugly criticism. If you have the feeling that the people who are criticizing are only doing it because they want to make fun of you, or they only do it because of they want to be, get more popular themselves, for example, get more viewers, more likes and so, then I just try to brush it off. And I felt it was a little bit like that with both Andy Gray, but also Steve Nicol, because I didn't have any arguments from them why they had that attitude. And it's not because they can't laugh at me as a throwing coach, because I'm often laughing about myself. I think it's perhaps the weirdest job in the world. So they could easily laugh about my job, but they could have done it in another way. Instead of, I would think it was more appropriate if they were a little bit more curious. For example, Steve Nicol could have asked himself, why is Jürgen Klopp hiring him in the third season in a row? Why? How could he improve Liverpool from number 18 to number 1 in the Premier League on throwing possession? Is it just a coincidence, or is it just like coming there just for fun? You know, so sometimes, you know, it's fantastic when people criticize me, but you have to use arguments who are like in data or in knowledge. It's not enough just to say, I don't like it, it's crazy, it doesn't work. You know, then we can say that about everyone.
I'm one of those guys that, I mean, Jurgen Klopp, Pep Guardiola, they're right up there. They're probably the top two managers in the world. If Jurgen Klopp says, look, this works. For me, it works. And that's from an Arsenal fan. You've worked with Andy Robertson, Alexander Arnold and Joe Gomez, and you've said that they're probably a few of the best all-round throwers in the world. Who else are you working with that you are kind of really rating at the moment?
I'll say, first of all, I'm having several secret clubs too. I can't reveal. And in general, of course, I've been getting a lot of...
Are you sure?
Yeah. In general, I've been getting a lot of attention around Liverpool. Of course, that's also always good if you're a freelancer. But the reason why I've been like taking these threes out is because the story is already out there. So with Andy Robertson and Trent, it's more like, it's not necessarily how far they throw, but it's more about know when to throw fast, know when to have patience, seeing space is being created and so on and so on. And Joe Gomez, you know, he had a really world-class long throw-in, and even though Liverpool is not really, we're not really using long throw-ins towards the opponent's goal, we saw it in the match between England and Croatia with the 1-1 goal in the Nations League where he assists with his long throw-in. So that was the reason why I picked him out here. But, you know, I'm having a lot of fantastic throw-in players. And when I'm saying fantastic throw-in players, it's not only the throw-in takers, because it's just as important that you have players who are creating space for each other. And some players are fantastic, not only creating space for themselves, but just as important creating space for their teammates, because you have to do a lot of decoy runs too and know where to create space and have no different options. So I had a lot of these players on my teams too, and they're just as important as the throwers. So,
What's next for you? You're a busy guy anyway, but what's next for you? Have you got a book, more instructional videos?
Yeah, I'll say that first of all, I'm giving once in a while like some videos on my YouTube channel. It's not like all my secrets, because I want to reserve them for the clubs. But for example, I've been making my four best basic throw-in drills. You can use that from U10 to pros. I'm using that for my pro teams too. You can get them on thomasgronemark.com, my homepage. Already now, over 4,000 coaches from around the world have picked them up. Everyone is happy. So you know, I'm giving a lot of free stuff. Then I'm also writing a book about throw-ins. Already been writing over 80,000 words. So, but I don't know if I'll publish in 1 year or 3 years or 5 years. It's depending on, of course, how long it takes to write it, but it's also a little bit of strategy when to publish. So that's like my goal surrounding, book and free stuff. And so, and then with my throwing coaching jobs, it's a special time now with the Corona period, and there's a lot of travel regulations, especially to the UK. But I hope that from this summer, it's like really, you know, really going on. I've already, for the next season, signed two contracts with two professional clubs. A lot of interest, not only from Europe, but outside Europe too. So I think we are going, or at least I'm hoping we're going a little bit more towards normal circumstances with traveling and so. So my goal is to coach at least 8, 10 professional teams, you know, the next season. And then perhaps a future goal could also be to coach a national team either towards the European Championships or the World Cup or some things like that. So all in all, for me, it's like an adventure. I'm traveling a lot, seeing the world. So I just want to continue with this as long as possible.
It's not a bad life, is it?
No, you know, it's fantastic. Because of course, I'm preparing a lot, doing video analysis, also training in the clubs, of course. But normally when I'm in foreign countries, I'm having 4, 6, 8 hours for myself per day, depending on the training schedule and so. And I always try, and I'm not in the Corona period, but normally to go to museums, seeing architecture, seeing nature, you know, everything. So it's not only been giving me, you know, a good job, earning decent wage too, but it's also giving a lot of great experiences all around the world. So yeah.
I've got to be honest with you. When I saw the videos, I was quite blown away, because I didn't realize that you know, the emphasis that you place on various points and the task that you do. It was amazing. And then I start looking at matches differently with the throw-ins. And I've got to tell you, a lot of the throw-ins I've seen could do with you.
Yeah, there are a lot of bad throw-ins out there. And for me, it's really scary that, first of all, a lot of teams are still just throwing the ball up the line, hurling it up there. A lot of teams, the players just standing still. Of course, you make it difficult for the fullbacks or whoever takes the throw-in. And then also just, you know, see a lot of unprecise throw-ins. So even though it may sound like drills for kids that you have to throw it precise to the feet, in, you know, I still see throw-ins hurled to the stomach or to the chest when it had to go to the feet. I still see throw-ins put into pressure zones 5 meters from the thrower. Of course you lose the ball then if you're doing these things. But I don't blame anyone, because where should you start? It's all about lack of knowledge. So I'll try to give that to people out there, no matter where they are in the world.
Thomas, thanks ever so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure. Hopefully you'll come back and see us in a little while.
Yeah, you're absolutely welcome. And maybe we see each other in the future again.
Yeah, I wish you all the best. Take care.
Yeah, you too. You too, yeah. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. Fun, football and conversation.
Right then, let's look at the first leg of the Europa League tie between Benfica and Arsenal. The importance of taking the few chances served up at this stage of the Europa League competition can't be overstated, as in my preview of Arsenal-Benfica, I really laboured the point. After a fine hat-trick against Leeds, one would have thought that a rejuvenated Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang would have gobbled up any hint of an opening to increase his goal tally for the season. But worryingly for Arsenal, his radar was off as he fluffed a series of decent chances that could have seen Arsenal leave Rome with 4 goals to the good and sitting comfortably for the next leg. However, the Gunners appear to prefer a challenge, and after Pizzi scored a penalty from a supposed handball, Arsenal's player of the season so far, Bukayo Saka, showed his captain how to put the ball in the net. He threatened to do so on more than one occasion, and one sensed that it was a case of cometh the hour, cometh the nearly man. Well, at 19, I find myself having to curb my excitement for this player in terms of what he and Arsenal could achieve in the coming seasons with just a few more tweaks in personnel. I don't think I've seen the same kind of progress from anyone in such a short space of time, other than Wayne Rooney when he announced himself as a talent in the Premier League for Everton in October 2002 with a sublime curling goal against Arsenal. The only difference is that Saka has more finesse and ability than Rooney ever had, and he could well be twice as big a name at this rate. I digress. Let me get back to the match. Arsenal are now in a finely poised fixture where mistakes often unfairly determine the passage through to the next round. And if that happens, then they will look back at this first leg and rue their failures to convert possession and dominance into goals. Replaying the moment, Bellerin manufactured a divine cross after 19 minutes into the path of the advancing Aubameyang. A goal looked almost inevitable. A meat and potatoes tap-in to put Arsenal ahead, but it remained free from the confines of the Benfica net. I leapt off the sofa, convinced that the Gunners' captain had played a vital role in this game, and I probably looked as dumbfounded as he did when the ball managed somehow to go wide of its intended resting place. That moment looks awfully familiar in the history of Arsenal's failed European adventures and looms ominously over the return tie, which will almost certainly be a tense watch. Arsenal's reply was mainly the product of the silky foot of Odegaard, who put a precise pass into the advancing Cedric. He in turn delivered a beautiful cross to Saka to ram home from 6 yards out. The relief was instant, but it was a rare highlight in an otherwise dull affair against a fairly ordinary opponent. But let's not be fooled here. Benfica will go up a gear in the return and have the potential to reverse this tie. Arteta had fielded a side that looked adventurous and exciting, but the glimpses of its potential were all too few, and it left the viewer slightly baffled and confused. This may be one of those occasions where you have to grip tightly onto the arm of the sofa, hide behind the cushion, and drown your anxiety in a tray full of beer. Arsenal have to take their chances, otherwise they'll be out.
It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. Fun, football, and conversation.
It's time to enter the gun room for a natter.
Nice to have you back, Jay, in the old gun room, clanking doors and all the rest of it. How you been doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Yeah, very well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. So we're going to change the format slightly. We're going to do a top five favourite players. It's kind of based on a Desert Island Disc kind of idea. So we're going to call it Desert Island 5. And Jay's the first one that's going to do it. So it'll be really interesting. I don't know what he's going to say. I don't know who he's picked. But I have made notes just in case.
Fantastic. Right, shall I get going with number five then?
Yeah, let's have number five.
Okie dokie. So number five, I'm going for Mr. Tony Adams.
Ah.
Obviously, captain fantastic. He expected the best and he delivered the best. He expected everything from every player that he played with. He was part of some fantastic, back lines at Arsenal. Famous, the famous back four, back five. He won league titles as the club captain, I think, in three consecutive decades.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, some of the standout performances or moments, goal v Spurs in the FA Cup in 93, the header at the old Wembley.
It's always special, isn't it? always special with Spurs.
Yeah. Obviously, the goal versus Everton in front of the North Bank when he stood there and the sun was shining on him, after all of his drinking issues and all of the, his personal problems. That was such a great moment,
Yeah, and iconic.
Yeah. One of the Premier League's iconic moments, right? And like I said, like I mentioned, he had obvious personal problems and he recovered so well. And he's a role model for a number of different reasons, but what a great captain.
And a great advert for any brewery.
Yeah. What a great captain, both for England, and more importantly for Arsenal.
Well, he turned his life around, didn't he, really? Because he's highly involved now with addictive personalities and stuff. He's got his own charity, so he does a lot of work. He's kind of made his experience count in a more positive way. So yeah. that was good.
Yeah.
Just to throw a bit of information, because I've been kind of playing detective.
Right.
Thinking, who's he going to choose? So I put Tony Adams down there because I thought, well, that's a no-brainer, isn't it? 669 appearances, 48 goals. Played for Arsenal from 1983 to 2002. Big surprise, only got 66 caps for England. Mm-hmm. I think that was, that wasn't expected. Played in four major tournaments, 1987 to 2000, and made his debut for Arsenal at the age of 17.
Wow. Some stats. Yeah. You highlight the England, I suppose, in the middle of his career, he had all of his personal problems, which obviously kept him away for a little while. But such a great central defender, right? Just pure all-out defender. And not as bad a footballer as some people made out. He was referred to as the donkey, wasn't he? But
yeah, they used to make donkey noises.
But he wasn't anywhere near as bad. I didn't think technically, he was good on the ball, could pass, but yeah.
I think when he needed to, he kept it simple, but he could actually play a ball.
Yeah, absolutely.
He comes up on Arsenal's top 50 at number three. So it'd be interesting to see how you match up with them. Number three. So on to number four.
So I'm going to go for Mr. Dennis Bergkamp.
Mm.
So when I used to play football, I was a forward. And so this is going to reflect in my this top five. So Bergkamp comes in at four. Technically, for me, the best player we've ever had. He joined the club under Bruce Rioch in a period where we were transitioning from sort of the old George Graham era. And we were obviously going into the Arsene Wenger era. And when he joined, he single-handedly sort of rose the profile of the club. Just basically, like I said, just by himself. He was a superstar, world superstar. So many assists, great technical moments. You know, you think of his hat-trick versus Leicester at the old Filbert Street.
I've actually got that down here, yeah.
Where he won, I think he won BBC Match of the Day, Goal of the Month. He had all three spots. You know, he got the top three.
There's also 1997, that.
Wow, 97.
You can tell because I've got the notes here.
Yeah, obviously, this wasn't for Arsenal, but his goal for the Netherlands against Argentina in 98, where it was, you know, he pulled the ball down from a long pass and flicked it over the oncoming defender and popped it in the top corner. Brilliant player.
That particular move is just so Bergkamp, isn't it?
The
ball comes over, he plucks it out of the air. No player should really be able to do that, but he just kind of not only plucks it out of the air, but the control that he puts on that ball afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose if you were going to describe, he's probably the most like an artist, like a footballing artist, you know, that you'd ever really come across. And a slightly different side to him, you know, he was a hard man as well. You know, he was a tough guy. He was he gave as good as he got from an era where he was playing against defenders such as Rio Ferdinand or John Terry, some of the, you know, tough guys, I suppose, and he gave as good as he got. He was quick, scored brilliant goals. And another one that you can imagine players coming into the club, seeing somebody like Dennis Bergkamp training, you know, that's only going to make you improve, right? He had his, you know, he's infamous for not flying towards the end of his career.
Yeah, the non-flying Dutchman.
Yeah, yeah.
Did that.
But, you know, there's so many moments, so many clips on YouTube of him doing just unbelievable things with the football, and what a great player.
Well, he came to us from Inter Milan, 1995, as you said, up to 2006. The cost was, do you remember what the cost was?
Was it 7 million? 7.5 million?
7.5 million.
Ah, yeah, there you go.
Appearances, 423. Goals, 120. But the thing was, a lot of people criticised him and said that he should have had more goals. Fair enough, if that's your thing. But for me, when Bergkamp scored, it was like a collector's item.
Yeah.
You know, the goal against Newcastle, 2002.
Yeah.
Where he just mugged off, what's his name? Nikos Dabidas.
Dabizas.
I mean, that probably is my favourite Arsenal goal of all time.
Yeah, the whole movement. And it's amusing that, you know, for so long, and I think even to this day, some still think he didn't mean it, but the way he turned him inside and out, and then took the ball straight away and put it underneath. Was it Shea Given in goal?
Yeah, it was.
Newcastle. Yeah. All in one,
and he's no movement. Mug.
No. And then it was just the way. And another thing about that goal, the way he celebrated, and it was just like a fist bump. And it's like, you know, this is what I do. This is what Dennis Bergkamp does. You know, this is.
Some of the players were saying that. Were you surprised about it? I can't remember what player it was now, but he said he does things like that every week in training.
Does it in training?
So, you know, and Ian Wright as well, you talking about, you know, he was quite tough. Mm-hmm. And Ian Wright said, yeah, he could mix it. He could definitely be dirty when he needed to be.
Yeah, yeah.
But, number four, do you know where he comes in the Arsenal list?
I would say top five.
Yep, number two.
Number two.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
But as you say, all these thinking about doing this, all these players that are going to come forward, they won't be what everyone expects in the order they expect them.
Yeah.
Because it is a very personal thing.
Yeah. When you have to pick a top five, it's incredibly difficult. And if you ask me this question again, say next week or the week after, I'd probably have a different top five. Because we've been so lucky, haven't we, to have so many great players, especially recently, sort of the last, under Arsene Wenger, we had so many great times and these players contributed so heavily to that.
Right then, let's move on to number three. Who's your choice for number three?
So number three is Mr. Patrick Vieira. He signed for the club, I think it was back around, I would say, I should have done my research a bit better.
1996.
And he came from AC Milan. And I remember him coming on, I think it was against Sheffield Wednesday. This sort of gangly... a bit of a nobody, right? And straight away, it was like, this guy is special. You know, he was a colossus of a midfielder. He formed a great partnership with Manu Petit. And he was, you know, it was for such a big guy, he was a box to box, popped up with the odd goal. And he grew into, alongside Tony Adams, an immense captain, a leader, somebody that was fearless. He drove the team forward at times, great on the ball, and, you know, some, you know, super brilliant battles with Roy Keane, you know, down the years. Two great sides, the Arsene Wenger Arsenal and Alex Ferguson's Man United.
I always remember that one in the tunnel where Keane obviously got upset about him approaching Gary Neville.
Yeah.
And words were exchanged and he was like, I'll see you out there.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. Oh my, here we go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was, I think I put him at number three because out of anyone on this list and any other Arsenal player, I was gutted most when he left. I don't know why. I don't know why it hit me harder than any of the other players, but when he left to go to Juventus, I thought it was the wrong decision. Obviously, we had a young Cesc Fabregas to come in and who did pretty well for the club as well. But yeah, he was the one I was most gutted about.
Yeah, 1996 to 2005, 406 appearances, 33 goals. How much did he cost? Real bargain.
I can't remember. 2.5 million, maybe.
Not far off it. 3.5.
Three and a half million. Yeah. Well, there you go. You know, and in today's money, it would be nothing, would it? So,
club captain in 2002, and it all started to go a bit pear-shaped in about 2001 when they started selling the players off. Mm-hmm. He criticised Arsenal for selling, and that was probably the main part of where it started going wrong for Arsenal and Patrick Vieira. Mm-hmm. Just to let you know, he's number five in the Arsenal top 50.
Number five, yeah. Yeah, great player. I was such a big fan. I got, you know, when he was playing for the club, I think I got about three or four shirts with his name on the back, you know. Leader. And without him, we were a different side, right? With him in the team, in the middle of the park, he was just dominant. And he formed a couple of good partnerships, didn't he? Like I said, firstly with Emmanuel Petit and then Gilberto.
Yeah.
So, yeah, great player.
Right then, on to number two. I've done so many notes here because I'm trying to guess where you're going. I know one of them.
Yeah. So number two is Mr. Thierry Henry. Pace, power, skill. He was so consistent season in, season out. He would contribute with goals, with assists, and he did it all with, in his words, that va-va-voom. His goal versus Real Madrid, you know, iconic goal where he carries the ball. You know, he does about three or four of them and then pops it in the bottom corner. His goal versus Liverpool in the, I think we beat him 4-2 in the run-in to winning the Premier League that season at Highbury, where he put Carragher on his backside and put it in the bottom corner in front of the North Bank.
That's where Carragher deserves to be.
And he delivered, didn't he? You know, he was
always.
Yeah. He tended to pull out onto that left hand side. That was his sort of his trademark, wasn't it? He'd tend to curl it into the far corner or power it, or you know.
You know, when he first came to us in, it was 1999, wasn't it? When he first came to us, I was running a pub. And I always used to have the Arsenal games on. And a friend of mine came in and he'd only just started playing. He played about six games or something. And this guy went, he's rubbish. I don't know why we bought him.
Yeah.
And about two seasons later, I suddenly remembered, I saw him, like he didn't come in the pub anymore, but he moved away. And I saw him and I said, oh, that Thierry Henry is rubbish, isn't he?
I mean, so he was signed to replace Anelka, wasn't he? If that's right.
Yeah, the main thing was Wenger wanted Anelka and Henry as the strike force. Could you imagine that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I suppose there's a... Would you say... Because he was playing for Juve, wasn't he? And not
as a winger,
not really having the best time. They'd won the World Cup, hadn't they, France, by then? Is that right? He was a World Cup winner, and we signed him as a winger, wasn't it? And then was it a hat trick against Southampton about sort of 9 or 10 games in at the old Dell? And then he never really looked back, did he?
26 goals in his debut season.
Wow.
It's not a bad return, is it?
That's
fantastic. How much
do
you reckon he was?
Oh, no, let me think. 11 million, was it?
It was, bang on, yeah.
Oh,
he was a Golden Boot winner 2001-02, 2003-04, 2004-05, 2005-06.
Wow.
Not bad for a rubbish player. Player of the season 2003-2004, player of the season 2005-2006. And that's the year he became club captain. 377 appearances, 228 goals, surpassing Mr. Ian Wright.
That's just unbelievable, isn't it? Those stats, you know, and how many assists in all of that, you know? Doesn't he still hold the Premier League record for assists? Or, you know, I'm sure he's right up there in a season. And I remember, Arsene Wenger back in the day when Henry was winning all those golden boots, Wenger would regularly comment on the goals are good, but it's the assists that impressed Wenger the most. You know, he was contributing from that point of view as well. So, I mean,
you mentioned some of the games. I remember the goal where the ball came to him. I think he had his back towards the Man United goal.
Yeah.
And he just flipped it and dinked it straight over Schmeichel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing goal.
What a goal.
Ripped the roof off the pub.
What a goal.
Southampton, 1999, debut goal. That was just from outside the box. But
The Spurs
absolutely,
goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The solo run. Everyone backing off.
Mm-hmm. Scared, amazing. Weren't they? They were petrified of him. And he picks the ball up, was it just outside our area? And he's out on the right-hand side, isn't he? That sort of the right-hand side of our, as we're attacking them, takes on two or three players. And then it's just like, they either have to foul him or they're not going to tackle him because he's too fast for them. And then he just, after doing everything that he did in the build-up to the goal, he just side-foots it into the bottom corner.
The footwork he had was amazing, wasn't it? Left to right, right to left. And he could do that all day long, ping-pong between his feet. Right then, I've got a feeling I know your number one.
I think you do. I think you do.
I've written all these down. The other ones that I thought you might mention, so I'll just go over those. Robert Pires, which must have been in your thinking.
Yeah, definitely.
Marco Overmars.
Yeah, Marco Overmars. Freddie Ljungberg was one of my favourites. Jose Antonio Reyes, I really liked him. And like I said, there's so many. I used to like really like Gilberto, Sol Campbell. You know,
as you say, blessed, really yeah. blessed.
Yeah.
Come
yeah,
on, then.
The number one is Mr. Ian Wright. I think you obviously knew that.
I thought it might be.
Yeah, he. I mean, you know, for so many reasons. I mean, I've mentioned them to you before. You know, he was Arsenal for me growing up. He was all the goals, all the celebrations, the passion, his attitude. You know, his he was just simply the best. He you know, he played in a number of different Arsenal sides, and I was so happy when he managed to get that Premier League winners' medal. You know, because by then, you know, he wasn't the main man, was he? You know, he was on the way out. You know, Anelka was coming through and probably taking his place. But I was so happy for when he won that the Premier League that season. You know, he didn't manage to. I think he was suspended for the Cup Winners' Cup final, wasn't he, against Parma? But he was still at the stadium cheering up the supporters. You know. And he was there.
As probably. He does now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so many goals. There was a goal he scored against Swindon. If you remember that one where it was a good 40, well, seemed like a good 40 yards out, you know, and he chips it and he lobs the keeper. Goal against Everton where, you know, he's doing almost keepy-ups over the defender's head and then lobs Neville Southall. In front of the North Bank cardboard mural, didn't really get a fair shot at England, did he? I don't think Graham Taylor really fancied him. And I mean, there's no question that he was the best striker for a good four years at that point.
It's quite interesting that his career at Arsenal is quite short. Came over from Crystal Palace. 1991 to 1998.
Yeah.
And he was 2.5 million. Mm-hmm. 228 appearances and he scored 185 goals. So he was the man.
How much would he cost somebody like that in this day and age? You know, you're talking pure goals. You're talking, he played in the boring Arsenal, whatever you want to say, but he wasn't boring. You know, he was pure value for money, you know. And I mean, even still now, he's just loved, isn't he? You know, by everybody to do with.
There's a couple of really quite funny stories because I saw him recently with Saka. Mm-hmm. And Saka said that all he could hear when Wright is there at the ground is Ian Wright cheering him on. Come on, yes, lads, come that's on.
Brilliant. You know, fantastic. Fantastic. And, yeah, he's just the best, isn't he? You know, he's the best. He sort of came into professional football quite late, didn't he? Quite a few knockbacks. But I mean,
I remember reading at one time he was earning 30 quid.
Yeah.
30 quid.
Yeah. I mean, I think he had problems. You know, he spent some time in prison briefly. But, you know, what a player.
Have you seen the documentary with him talking about David Rocastle?
Yeah. I mean, they were really close.
Tight, yeah.
Yeah, they lived on the same housing estate. And I think Rocastle, being a few years older, was they became friends, obviously, because they were both good at football. And, you know, he gets quite emotional, doesn't he, Wrighty, when he talks about Rocastle and about how, you know, when Arsenal ended up winning the title at Anfield in 89, you know, right to, you know, will say, you know, just how happy he was that somebody from around there where they lived managed to be part of something like that.
Great film as well, wasn't it, 89?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, we've got it.
Perfect evening for an Arsenal fan is fever pitch and 89.
Yeah.
And a case of beer.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so yeah, that's my top five.
That's been brilliant. And you're the first one, obviously. Let's do Under the Spotlight, where we check out a particular player for whatever reason, just have a look at their performance in general. Who's your player for that?
Right, so I've decided to go for Hector Bellerin. He's somebody that, you know, he's being scrutinised quite heavily at the moment. You know, he's 25 years old. Seems, you know, to me anyway, you know, you'd expect him to be a few years older than that. He seems to have been around for quite a while. You know, heading towards 200 appearances for the club. And Spanish international, obviously somebody that Arteta relies on and values, you know, his experienced member of the squad. And it's almost yearly that he seems to be linked with moves away from the club. But he always tends to, you know, those links never really seem to go anywhere. He was known for his sort of excellent recovery speed, which
has gone slightly now, isn't
which
it?
Is
since
diminished.
The injury. Yeah, and I think injury. That's why fans are looking. I mean, I was slightly on that bandwagon as well, because Holding and Bellerin on that side, it wasn't the best, because Holding's flat-footed at the best of times.
Yeah.
And Bellerin's lost that yard and a half.
He has. And I think that is ultimately, it's exposing him more, isn't it? You know, it's exposed. Whereas maybe, you know, positionally this season, he's been caught out quite a lot. And whereas in previous years, he's been able to recover. You know, I don't know if you remember a few years back against Swansea away. There's a great clip where Swansea go through one-on-one and Bellerin must be 10, 15 yards behind the striker. And he makes up all of the ground and makes a covering tackle, you know, and that was what Bellerin was all about, you know, his sheer speed, you know. And I know there's many other clips, and there's one against Barcelona as well, when he's bombing down the right hand side and he produces a good cross. You know, that's not there anymore. He's nowhere near as bad as I think he's being made out to be. You know, he's still a good player, but he hasn't got the pace. And I think maybe subconsciously, I don't know, maybe he's ready for a move away from the club, you know?
I think he probably is, yeah. Mm. I think the only thing to kind of help him out really is to get a right-footed player at centre of defence.
Yeah.
That is quick. Mm-hmm. Holding isn't quick. Luis isn't quick.
Yeah.
Gabriel's left-footed, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
So that's not going to help. So
that's a great point. That's a great point.
Saliba, what's Saliba? Because he's right footed, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
So he'd be ideal.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, he's playing in an ever changing Arsenal back line. I know we've been a bit better this season, but the Arsenal defense, you know, it isn't great. And it's not his fault, you know, but you know, he's part of an ever changing back line that. You know, I just think maybe the player, the club, and the fans, you know, I think it's probably about the time that maybe he could, you know, this summer could be the time when he moves on. But I like him, you know, personally, I like him as a player. He can still do a job.
Well, let's talk about his defensive frailties. Let's talk about what he brings to attack. I mean, you know, let's not forget that. Because when I think it was in the cup final, wasn't it? When he went on that surging run, he just ripped Chelsea wide open. They took him out, but he'd already passed the ball to Aubameyang.
Mm-hmm. And I think
he's like that all the time, isn't he? He will get up.
Oh yeah, yeah. And that's what I'm saying. He can still offer a lot, and that is definitely part of his game. Getting forward, he's always looking to go forward. It's clear that Arteta wants the fullbacks, and you've got Tierney on the other side, and whether it's Bellerin or Cedric on the right. But yeah, like you say, he can offer that. You know, he's got a goal in him. He's got a lot of big, you know, it was just last season. I know Martinelli got the headlines for his goal against Chelsea, but it was Hector's goal that got us the 2-2, you know. He scored, I think it was a goal against Man United. You know, he can offer us something. You know, he's still a good player. He's just the pace, unfortunately for him, that was such a massive part of his game has diminished.
Do you think the fans basically have just shifted their focus? You know, 1 minute it's David Luiz, then it's Xhaka, now it's Bellerin, you know, it'll be someone else. Pepe's always in the frame. William, you know, obviously William is something different, but they tend to pick their focus. Even Leno, who for me has been probably the most consistent player.
Been fantastic.
Years.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely that. We've spoke about the fan base before, haven't we? About how unrealistic, really, the expectations are upon the players. You know, they are going to make mistakes, and they have, you know, a large portion of the fan base does seem to need a fall guy. And he seems to be it. I'll reiterate what I said. He's nowhere near as bad as some are making out. He's just, the focus is on him now. So every mistake is being highlighted a little bit too much, you know. But it would be a shame if he left in the summer after being criticised for the rest of the season, because, you know, he's been part of this period of time for Arsenal Football Club where, okay, we may have dropped somewhat in the league, but he's been part of, he won 4 FA Cups, definitely been part of those 4 FA Cup winning sides. And he's played nearly 200 games for the club. So
I'm like you, I like him. Injury's obviously done something to him, and he's battling back, probably a little bit like Rob Holding is trying to battle back. I don't think he'll reach the heights that he did.
No.
But I don't think he deserves all the nonsense he's getting as well. You know, we're quite lucky to have him. There's far worse in the Premier League.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think with what we've got currently at the moment, you know, Cedric is doing okay, but I think the expectations are low for Cedric. You know, if he does well, it's amazing, because, you know, he's the expectations are different for him. And I think whoever we got, if we do have to replace him, if they don't hit the ground running, the fan base is just the way it is. We just jump on those players, right? That player. So I feel a bit for him for the amount of abuse that he gets, you know. I think away from the club, you know, he's interested, you know, his fashion ventures and, you know, his interests in fashion. I think people could criticise him for that, you know, absolutely ridiculously. But
he offered those out looking like a laundry basket, didn't he?
Yeah. It's just like people use that to hit, you know, bash him.
Well, Beckham did it as well.
And there was an interview with Bellerin for a radio station, and, you know, he's an investor in Forest Green. And they are the first professional football, semi-professional or football club that are 100% green, I think, something like that anyway. And he's a big part in that. And, you know, because he's slightly different, or his interests are slightly different from your typical footballer, you know, people use that to bash him with, and it's just, it doesn't sit right with me. When really, you know, okay, he hasn't been great recently, but I'd like to think that people could grant him a little bit of leeway, especially if this is the last few months of his career with us, you know.
So would you sell him or keep him?
I would sell him. I would sell him, not because of how badly he's been, but I just think maybe the performances, or the level of performance that we're seeing from him, not that he's doing it on purpose, but I just think maybe he's ready for the move. As a club, we have somebody in Cedric that I think could do an equally as good job. But then again, you know, I do like him. It's a tough one. If I was Arteta and he came into my office in the summer after the last game of the season and said, you know, I think it's right, or I think I'm ready for a move, you know, I would grant him that move, you know. So,
yeah. Well, Jay, listen, we've run out of time again.
Yeah.
We get chatting away and time just disappears, isn't it?
It does.
Thanks ever so much. And we'll see you. And we'll do this profile thing again, because I think it just opens up a lot of topics.
Fantastic. Look forward to it.
All right, then, mate. Thanks very much. Care. Cheers.
Okay. Bye-bye.
It's an Arsenal Thing podcast. Fun, football, and conversation.
It's time to nip over the pond.
From the land that gave you popcorn, drive-ins, Johnny Mathis, and the legitimate right to shoot your neighbor for parking outside your house, direct from the U.S. of A., it's a potpourri of foosball analysis and stuff. It's American Arsenology.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once again to American Arsenology. Brought to you by Michelob Ultra Organic Seltzer. We don't know why it exists either. I'm your host, Pretentious Johnson. And now, tonight's top stories. Welcome back to the program, me Gunners and Gunnerettes. Hope you're all hanging in. After the 1-0 defeat to the mighty Manchester City. Yes, folks, seeing a diminutive Raheem Sterling climb above two Arsenal defenders in the heart of our six-yard box, heading home the only goal of the game, was indeed a tough pill to swallow. Let's get right into the action. The opening narrative of this one was all about apprentice versus master. As Mikel Arteta hosted his former guru, Pep Guardiola, at Emirates Stadium on Sunday. Yes, Arteta chose to go with the magic peacoat and a grey turtleneck. Pep came to battle dressed in a grey hoodie, supporting the Open Arms NGO based in Catalonia. There were some wholesale lineup changes in this one. After Mikel Arteta's men drew midweek with Benfica in the Europa League, Arteta chose to restore the partnership of Rob Holding and Pablo Mari. He also reintroduced Mohamed Elneny, Nicolas Pepe, and Kieran Tierney into the starting 11. None of the changes were of surprise here to us at American Arsenology. Unfortunately for Rob Holding and for Arsenal, things did get off to the worst possible start, as just in the second minute of the match, Riyad Mahrez was given way too much time and space by Mr. Tierney to serve an enticing ball into the heart of the penalty area. The minuscule and mercurial Raheem Sterling levitated, unimpeded, unencumbered, in the heart of the six-yard box to score what was essentially a free header between the hapless Rob Holding and Hector Bellerin, trademark TM. It was god-awful defending from Mr. Holding, and another example, sadly, of why he is not good enough to start for Arsenal. Yes, folks, the Englishman is a solid squad player, but nothing more. And while Lee Dixon on the NBC broadcast was correct to criticize Mr. Kieran Tierney for allowing the cross in itself, it is Rob Holding who has to do better in that situation. For all the fans singing Mr. Holding's praises during the unbeaten run, it's a good thing to remember. The run was against the weakest teams in the league. And this is your public service announcement that Rob Holding is an average player. Sorry to bear the news. So then, 1-0 to City, 1-0 to Mahrez, with the assist as he stepped into his dirty 30s on his birthday. In the fifth minute, it was close to being 2-0 City, as Bellerin went to sleep, and Raheem Sterling was put in clean on goal from a brilliant Kevin De Bruyne pass. The City winger took a few extra touches, unnecessarily I might add, and squandered what was a sensational pass from the Belgian. And a few minutes later, it was Mahrez, shooting, having a shot deflected, earning a corner. The boat kept rocking for Arsenal, and they were at risk of capsizing early on. With the Paisley floodwaters set to drown out any spark of life from the rattled home side. Finally, in the 17th minute, the Gunners came up for a bit of air, as Bukayo Saka and Kieran Tierney combined well down Arsenal's left flank, producing a move that ended with a fine block by Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who got in the way of Saka's shot that looked to be goalbound. Saka had been moved over to the left wing to help control Mahrez, as well as provide a pathway for Nicolas Pepe to feature in this one. Moving Saka to the left largely failed, and here at American Arsenology, this was one of the key takeaways from the match versus Manchester City. Yes, we have zero qualms with Arteta playing a weaker side versus City. Zero. Big fat donut. In fact, we appreciate the move. City are flying, and the unreal winning streak they are on continues. The truth is, Arsenal were never winning this one without a fit Thomas Partey. Punto y final. Period. As a manager, you must play to win every match. But going with Pablo Mari and Rob Holding at the back, and playing Mohamed Elneny in the midfield, was clear indication that Arteta's priorities were firmly locked on the Eagles of Benfica. Yes, folks, Lisbon was on the brain. Lisbon and the Brain, only on TBS, Thursdays, 5 p.m. Yes, the second leg versus the Eagles was clearly the priority, along with a steady dose of revenge against Brendan Rodgers, who did Arteta so dirty, outfoxing him at the Emirates by absorbing for 80 minutes and then pulling the old smash and grab with a Jamie Vardy special. There's no doubt, it's unequivocal, Arteta seeks revenge on Rodgers, just as he did on the crafty old owl, Marcelo Bielsa. The rub or problem, however, was playing Saka in this one. Saka should have been rested against City because Benfica is so important. Now Arteta will start him again on Thursday in a game he must play in. It's that big. It's that important. Arsenal cannot be without Saka against Benfica. But from a purely health and fitness standpoint, that logically means he won't feature much against Leicester City. Whether he plays or not, the minutes are mounting, and I did not like the choice of Arteta playing Saka in a game he was already throwing away with his lineup. But I digress. In the 30th minute, Kieran Tierney got a good pass from Granit Xhaka and was able to fizz in a shot on the old Brazilian banana hammock. Edison then turned the save into a quicksilver transitional moment, sending Kevin De Bruyne on his way. I tell you, folks, if the Belgian had been a bit sharper, a bit more match fit, it would have been a truly dangerous counter-attack started from the keeper. And in the 43rd minute, there was a big chance for Arsenal, when Nico Pepe and Hector Bellerin trademark TM combined well. Bellerin won a crucial header and then made a great run into the box. But Nicolas Pepe took one touch too many. And if he had played the ball earlier, Arsenal would likely have leveled. That said, it was a great recovery run by Ilkay Gundogan, and a chance that Nicolas Pepe just wasn't sharp enough to take. The half came to its thankful conclusion, and there were several big takeaways. First, Mikel Arteta showed his hand by playing what should be our Europa League group stage pairing of Holding and Mari. Yes, his mindset was all about the quote-unquote cup final against Benfica on Thursday. Number two, Bukayo Saka should not have started. It was the perfect game for the minute-hungry Alexander Lacazette to feature in. Saka should have been given a few well-deserved days off. And third, Hector Bellerin. Once you've met a Hector, you know a Hector. And as they say, if it sounds like a Hector, smells like a Hector, must be a Hector. While many in the fanbase have been criticizing the Spaniard, and worse, people need to recognize that Hector Bellerin has been pretty good this year. Dating back to the start of the season in September. No, he's not back to his best. And yes, there has been a downturn in the past few weeks. Yes. All of that is true. However, you do not get linked to PSG and Juventus just because you like to wear weird clothes. Fashion, turn to left, fashion, turn to left. Kevin De Bruyne got the second half a churning when he attempted an audacious effort to chip Bern Leno. And in the 50th minute, a slick turn by Mr. Saka drew a yellow card on Bernie Silva. Elneny played a hospital ball to Xhaka, who in turn got a card for the tackle he made, when the replay showed it was Sterling who had actually been the one to step on Xhaka. Well done, Johnny Moss. In the 55th, Gundogan forced a save from Leno. And a few minutes later, like a ginger Zeus, Kevin De Bruyne attempted to smash a volley straight from the sky. Joao Cancelo smacked Kieran Tierney in the head. And Moss said, "Here, have a card yourself, son." And then, in a strange turn of events, Joao Cancelo sliced a ball into the upper atmosphere. The re-entry of the ball fell into the pathway of goalkeeper Edison, who was forced into a full-fledged karate volley in the 73rd. And by that time, ESR was coming on for Nico Pepe. It was largely a quiet day for Pepe. He was not quite in rhythm, having been unceremoniously dropped from the starting 11 after just beginning to look like he was close and on to something. In the 80th minute, Joao Cancelo should have scored. After leaving Mr. Rob Holding writhing in agony on the floor. Yes, poor Rob Holding caught a knee to the dome after sliding through in a noble effort to tackle Cancelo. Holding was concussed, and on came the curly-haired David Luiz for a 10-minute cameo that he surely did not need ahead of Benfica. Bellerin picked up a card for a foul on Gabriel Jesus, and the exhausted Kieran Tierney played a pass out of bounds, trying to find out Aubameyang, in a move that summed up the game for Arsenal. It was a match they were looking past from the opening whistle and word go. There were a few final takeaways from this one. First, Martin Ødegaard has not been mentioned up to this point, because frankly, he was a non-factor. It was a bit of a nothing burger performance. It would have been nice to see him playing with something to prove against a team like Manchester City. Ødegaard was not up for this one. He was not at the races. Second, Arsenal missed Emile Smith-Rowe's movement and pressing. And most importantly, his one-touch combination play and running off the ball. Arsenal's speed of play is much better when Smith-Rowe features. And finally, another game gone, with 0 minutes for Gabriel Martinelli. Let us all hope and pray that Mikel Arteta is not having more man management issues with one of his young players. Martinelli must be the future of Arsenal. He and Bukayo Saka are the truth. Arteta cannot afford to mess this one up. Tom, sending it back to you.
That's it, we're all done. Thanks to Silent Dave, to Isaiah. Check out his blogs at americanarsenology.medium.com or look him up on Twitter. Thanks to Jay, you'll find him on Twitter as the Bald Gooner. A massive, massive thank you to Thomas Gronemark. Look up his website, thomasgronemark.com. Leave your email address in the box provided and you get to check out the 4 free basic throw-in drills. Well worth it. Have a look. Shout outs to Soham D and Brandon Murphy. The music was supplied by Soundroll, and a special mention to ITV for borrowing the big match theme. Check out our blogs at askdevils.com or look us up on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you've heard today, please subscribe, follow or like. Until the next time, look after yourself, stay safe, and we'll see you again soon.